Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 15, 2003, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche gave the keynote address entitled "This Is Our Time" at the President's Day Conference of the International Caucus of Labor Committees and Schiller Institute, convened in Reston, Virginia. This week, part two of his keynote and responses to questions are presented as the second of a series of programs dedicated to this historic conference.
Mankind is born good. The best thing ever invented in the universe. But he does not necessarily mature too well. And therefore, we become susceptible to childish diseases or childhood diseases of humanity among adults. We become corrupt, like bad children in a schoolyard. And like a tyrannical schoolyard tyrannized by bullies. We create a corrupt society in that schoolyard or that society. Then a time comes where people no longer put up with that tyranny. And they know it, recognize it as wrong. And they're open to the possibility of changing it, of changing the rules. We've seen that a few times. But then they often lose that opportunity and slip behind. For that reason, so far, the history of humanity has depended upon leadership. For example, in Christianity, the exemplification of such leadership is a person of Jesus Christ. That's the image of the need for leadership to take a broken humanity, which found itself in the age of Tiberius and Augustus before him, under the rule of evil, under the rule of an evil which had taken over the society of the Mediterranean region. And in this evil, someone came as a leader, as a model of leadership, and sacrificed their life in a manner described by Socrates in Plato's writing on Socrates. To sacrifice their life willingly, not to flee from death, but to stand in place and put their life on the line for the sake of future humanity. That is a leader. Nothing else is a leader in a time of crisis. As we remember Martin Luther King in this connection, in his address, he stood and died, not for just African American people. He died for all humanity in the image of Christ, which inspired him. Or the beginning of modern European civilization, which was made possible by a little girl, not so little, but a girl, Jeanne d'Arc. Jeanne d'Arc refused to flinch in her mission and her courage in going to be burned alive by the Inquisition inspired France to create the first modern nation state and inspired to a great degree the Renaissance launched from Italy, which created modern society and brought us out of the Middle Ages, the darkness of the Middle Ages. It is always the kind of leadership which is exceptional and which has a certain specific quality, a quality which is called a sense of immortality. And that is what it takes to become a leader, effective leader in times of crisis. What happens, you have people like Bill Clinton, for example. I don't have any enmity against Bill Clinton. He's a very good guy. His choice of girlfriends is not always too good, but but a very bright guy. He's performing a useful role still, in some of the time anyway. But the point was, he flinched. He flinched. He does not have, at least not yet, that sense of immortality which is required to become a leader in times of crisis such as this one. Now, what is this mysterious quality of leadership, which for the Christian is typified by Christ, typified by the case of Socrates, typified by the description of the case of Socrates by Moses Mendelssohn, typified in our time by Martin Luther King's martyrdom for humanity, and the fact that nobody was there in a top position to pick up the role of leadership that he represented the moment he fell. What is this mysterious quality of leadership? Where does it come from? How does it work? What has it got to do with the youth movement? What is the nature of man? Talk about man, human rights, human nature. What is the nature of man? Man is certainly not a pig, much as we sometimes suspect it in some cases. No, man has something different about man, absolutely different from every form of animal life. What is it? It's exactly what you don't get in the mass media today. You don't get it in your primary, secondary schools or universities. So you come out of these universities, out of these secondary schools, with no comprehension whatsoever of the most important subject of all. What is the difference between man and a beast? No conception whatsoever. What is the difference? Very simple, but not so simple. I've dealt with it many times, but it should be dealt with again because the lesson has not yet been learned, and we sometimes have to keep teaching the lesson until it is learned. We have, as human beings, we have what we call sense perception. Some people call it knowledge. It's not knowledge. What you detect with your senses is not necessarily true. And most of what you detect with your senses, you find out is not true. So therefore, how do you know anything? Some people make that argument. You don't know anything. You only have opinion. How do you know anything? Well, look at these. What are your sense organs? Your sense organs are part of your physical organism, living organism. Do you know what happens outside your skin? Do you have any sense of what happens outside your skin directly? No, none. What you know is what the outside world stimulates in your sense organs. And if you try to extrapolate from that and to assume that what you sense, the sense perception, is the real world, you get into a lot of trouble. So there in the course of time, we discover that we have gained knowledge of a world outside the senses. Take the case that I've often illustrated, gravity. Did you ever see a gravity? Huh? Did you ever taste one? Huh? No, it's a universal principle discovered by Kepler in a very specific way as reported in his 1609, The New Astronomy. You can never smell it. You can never touch it. You never see it. It's a universal principle. But you can prove its efficiency. Or take another principle, the principle of least action, which was first made clear by Fermat and then developed by Huygens and Leibniz into a principle of universal least action. Can you see it? Can you smell it? Can you taste it? No, not at all. But it exists. You can know it. You can use it. It is a power in and over the universe. Therefore, you know this because you are able to prove that by being guided by this principle rather than simply by your senses, you are able to increase man's power in and over the universe. That is what you know. Now, no animal can do it. Mankind, by discovering principles of this type, universal principles or approximations of universal principles, by a method described by Plato in his collection of dialogues called the Socratic method or the Platonic method. By these methods, mankind is able to discover universal principles and their application to such an effect that we increase the human power over nature per capita and per square kilometer. If, for example, if man were a higher ape, which some of our politicians do resemble in a certain respect, or maybe not so high, then the human species, under the conditions existing on this planet during the past 2 million years, would never have exceeded several million very poor quality individuals. Shoddy, shaggy, whatnot, short-lived. We now have over 6 billion human individuals on this planet. That's some orders of magnitude. That is a reflection of the difference between a human being and a monkey. It's precisely the ability to discover and apply universal principles and to share their discovery with others so that society changes its behavior to increase mankind's power in and over the universe. Right? Now, therefore, we have another quality of mankind. We're born and we die. That's another quality. Now, how do we put these two things together? Through social relations and through the discovery and transmission of universal principles, we are able, as people used to think like that, that one generation can sacrifice to bring its children's generation and its grandchildren's generation to a higher condition of life. Therefore, by sharing knowledge and transmitting it, we bring humanity from a poorer state to a higher state. We liberate mankind from oppressive conditions and bring it into a more noble condition. And the most noble thing we do is, as is said in the New Testament on the question of the talent, we use the talent of mortality, which is given to us. We invest it by expending it in such a way that our lives mean something to those who have gone before us and to those who come after us. Therefore, we have spent our talent wisely. What we can do that accomplishes that is to share in the discovery of universal principles, to relive the great discoveries made by people thousands of years before us, to transmit these discoveries as in education and other means to our contemporaries, and to share this to future generations and also to transmit to them the knowledge of how to continue this process of increasing man's power in and over the universe. Now, the issue here of leadership is this. If you are such a person who locates your identity in the past and future of humanity, that you are a reflection of what humanity has given to you in terms of this kind of knowledge, and you are an embodiment of what the rest of humanity will receive from you in the future, you have a different sense of identity than if you think in terms of what pleasures and pains you are going to enjoy within the realm of your mortal life. People who are concerned only with their neighborhood, their immediate pleasures and pains, are not capable of leadership because they can all be bought. They can be bought by the sense of pleasure within the confines of mortal life. Pleasure and pain can buy them all. Whereas if you see yourself as an instrument of past humanity and an instrument of future humanity, and see your mortal life as a link between the past of humanity and the future of all humanity, they can't touch you. They can't touch you. Which is what Martin was saying in that last speech. They can't touch you. They can take your life away from you. They can kill you. They can starve you. They can imprison you. But they can't touch you. Because what you are cannot be touched in that way. Huh? So therefore, you have to have a sense of immortality, as Jeanne d'Arc did. Jeanne d'Arc had a sense of immortality. They couldn't touch her. They said, we're going to burn you alive. They couldn't touch her. She was burned alive, and she changed history the way she intended to. She performed her mission for humanity. And that is a sense of immortality. This is called, in classical artistry, the sublime. It is the tragic. It's the person who's confined to mortal life as such. The person who thinks only what I enjoy and feel in mortal life is important. Such people can be bought by pleasure and pain. those who find their reality not in the pleasure and pain of mortal life, but in the ideas which they express as bearers of what was given to us by previous generations and what they are giving to future generations, they cannot be touched. They can be trusted. Anybody who does not think that way cannot be trusted, because they can be bought, like many of our people are bought these days. And therefore, the most important thing, and this gets to the issue of the youth movement, the most important thing is to produce among young people, when they are entering maturity, a sense, a true deep sense of immortality that is done precisely by forgetting all the things that are normally taught. Just put them to one side. You can come to know things much better, quicker way, and better. By reliving the acts of discovery, the great acts, for example, of scientific discovery, of physical science. Relive those acts performed by great people before you. Reenact that. Re-experience. Don't talk about Archimedes. Re-experience what happened in his mind as he made a discovery. Don't talk about how to interpret art. Live it. Experience the process of composition of the art. Experience doing it. Don't interpret it. Don't put on a costume like Laurence Olivier, the worst actor probably of the last century. Look at, you say, look at me, look at me, look at me. No great artist says, look at me. A great artist says, don't look at me. Experience what I'm doing. Experience what I'm doing. And then be surprised that you see me standing, this humble person, on the stage afterward, after I've done it. Because I'm only the vehicle of this. What you see is the vehicle. I'm doing it. So in what we must do is, therefore, is inculcate in our people a sense of this intimation, as poor Wordsworth said, of immortality. The intimation of immortality comes from this sense of love for all humanity. The kind of thing that is attributed to Christ. Love for all humanity. And by doing things which are necessary for all humanity. Think of people in the past, for example, who have suffered. You can't touch them. You can't reach them as mortal people. You can't go back to them and shake their hands. What you can do is you can understand the meaning of their life, the struggle of their life, and how to bring to realization that which they should have desired as a consequence of their having lived. You can't touch the future otherwise except by the same method. You touch it by participating in scientific discoveries. You touch it also by classical art, true classical art, in which the question is getting inside this process of the mind. How does one person communicate a discovery of principle to another mind? That's classical art. As I use the case often of this case of the cupola of Santa Maria da Fiore in Florence, where you have the principle of art, the great principle of all great sculpture, classical sculpture, which is the principle of least action. The catenary principle, which is expressed in the ability to construct the cupola under those conditions. So therefore you have the unity of science and the unity of classical art in one single act. And the communication of these ideas is a matter of art. And thus we enjoy these things. They become an art form for us. Whereas we think of classical science as man's individual relationship to the physical universe. We should think of art as the same concept applied to man's relationship to man in developing and conveying ideas about the universe and ideas of cooperation. So what we've come to is this. We've come to a time of great tragedy, of great potential tragedy, and great opportunity. We've come to a time as typified by the events of the past week in the United Nations and elsewhere, where mankind is shaken and we find people moving as they have not moved for a long time. Governments and others who you thought would never have given up on this, who they thought would have capitulated to the inevitability of a war. And even though the war has not yet been stopped, we've had an affirmation from humanity, from implicitly the majority, the great majority of humanity, saying this war shall not be allowed to occur. That is a great moment. We, therefore, must realize we are in such a time. We're in a time of great tragedy and a challenge of awakening of humanity in a way which is not possible in recent times, the past 40 years perhaps. And therefore, the question is, can we bring to this situation where the opportunity for change is here? Can we bring the spark of true leadership into this process? My view is, from study of history as confirmed by some of the reactions of young people who've been working with us in recent years, we can do it. But the key thing to do is you've got to inspire the young who wish to become that, to become an instrument for humanity. And you've got to use their sense of being an instrument to humanity to take the old fogies called their parents, those under 50, and convince them to join the movement to make sense out of the lives of baby boomers who mostly don't know what their lives are about. You know, a typical baby boomer, about 55 or 60, saying that. We had children, maybe. No, that was your other spouse's child. Oh, yeah. What do we ever want to do that for? And the young people today, who are the children of these marriages, or so-called marriages, say, yeah, we want it too. And therefore, what we have is we have a baby boomer generation which has lost its connection largely with humanity, which if young people can get this sense of what leadership is, as I've touched upon this today, and can inspire their parents' generation and others with a sense of what that leadership is. And if we, as in the United States in particular, can show that we represent the continuity of this nation, its true historic mission for humanity, I think we'll find the world is ready for us, is ready for us to play a leading role once again. And we who have been the dirtiest can become among the best. Thank you.
Now, as has become our custom, I'm going to turn the chair over to Deborah Hanania Freeman, the spokeswoman for LaRouche's presidential campaign, who will run the questions and answers for approximately the next hour and 40 minutes. You can stand up at the mic, but she will be organizing the questions, because we can assure you that people around the world have been listening to this address and will also have questions to ask. So, Deborah.
Good afternoon to all of you. As you know, as we're meeting here, the proceedings of today's conference are being broadcast over the internet. There are gatherings all over the United States and all over the world. As we proceed, and as has become our custom, I will take questions from the audience gathered here, but I will also be reading questions that have been submitted electronically, and I'll try to alternate back and forth, and we'll do it that way. And if you have any complaints, you can tell me later. What I'd like to do, actually, is start with a question from those gathered here. Charles, are you taking people's names? Okay. So the first questioner can come up to the microphone, and we will begin that way.
Hello, my name is Abdul Muhammad. Lynn, I was wondering the difference between metaphor and symbolism. And I was wondering, can you explain the difference?
Well, metaphor is actually an idea. A simile is not, first of all. Metaphor pertains to the gaps in description. That in all the classical dialogues of Plato involve the principle of metaphor. For example, let's take the case of, we've often done this before, and it probably will come up again. It's a common example we've used ever since Bruce Director got at this some years ago. On the case of the discovery of the principle of gravitation, that in decadent culture, which was Romantic culture, up through the 16th century, or most of it, it was generally believed in Romantic culture that what we could know of the physical universe was merely a description of some consistent pattern of behavior as observed with the senses. Now, what Kepler showed, and this was the character of the metaphor, was that the orbit of Mars in the first instance was not circular, which made it a fairly irregular motion. But worse than that, the motion within the ellipse was not uniform, even within the terms of the ellipse. But the motion was based on this principle of equal areas, equal time. So there was constant change in motion at all times. It was never uniform, it was always non-uniform. Now, on the basis of the fact that the orbit was elliptical, and then he carried that further to show how the solar system essentially functions in these terms, and on the basis of non-uniform motion, defined a principle of gravitation based on an anomaly, or a set of anomalies, the elliptical anomaly, the non-uniform motion anomaly, and others, which showed that something existed outside ordinary sense perceptual interpretation, which actually caused the universe to function the way it did.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of LaRouche's keynote address to the ICLC Schiller Institute President's Day Conference. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's keynote from our President's Day Conference 2003.
So therefore, anything which shows truthfully that in what people ordinarily believe from sense perception or mere description is not true is a metaphor. And you, for example, you would say gravitation. Now, some idiot would say gravitation is defined by Galileo. It is not. So the difference between gravitation as defined by Galileo and Kepler is a metaphor. You might use the same term as some people have, or Newton, the same thing. Newton's concept is absurd. Newton was actually plagiarized Galileo's interpretation of the publication of Kepler's New Astronomy. Okay, so Newton discovered nothing. Newton's system was based on a plagiarism of Kepler's New Astronomy, an English edition published in the latter part of the 17th century, is interpreted from the standpoint of the doctrine of Galileo. So to use the term gravitation in the two cases is metaphorical. because it means two opposite things, completely different kinds of things under different circumstances. All art means that. For example, the best case, of course, is simple Bachian counterpoint. You find if you change a direction, you get an opposition an apposition, which creates an irony, which creates a metaphor. The whole basis of Bach's composition is all metaphor. It is not simple mechanical rules. They're ironies. And the irony becomes an idea which emerges from the composition, which stands outside and above the composition. This is true in great poetry. For example, the most famous case is Keats' Ode to a Grecian Urn, the short poem by him. And everything is in there. Now, the irony is there, the metaphor is very simple. Remember, the classic characteristic of classical Greek sculpture is that instead of tombstone art, the figure is captured in mid-motion. So you're not looking at motion, at fixed standing body. You're looking at something captured in mid-motion, like a photograph in mid-motion. Now, the principle for doing that is demonstrated by the catenary principle, otherwise known as the principle of least action, as Leibniz's principle of least action. So therefore, what Keats is doing in describing that truth is beauty and so forth, and all these things about these figures which are captured in mid-motion, even though he's looking at a fixed object, a vase, an ancient vase, is a metaphor. And the metaphor is that if you know what he's talking about classical Greek sculpture and so forth, that sort of thing, you see the way he uses the idea that truth is beauty and beauty is truth. How does he make that equation? What do you mean, truth is beauty and beauty is truth? How do you make that equation? He did it. He referenced a metaphor in terms of the composition of this business. So a metaphor essentially means it's what lies between the gaps in sense perception, the principles which are not seen through sense perception, not seen by statistical deduction, but an irony of meaning, a complication in meaning, where two words don't mean the same thing in the same sentence, but in a different context. That's metaphor. Or the use of any of these devices. There's a famous book, which is I first acquired in 1946 or 47, about that time. I picked up in a bookstore. It was recently published in Boston. It was William Empson on varieties of on the subject, and it contains a good deal of it, and I've referred to it a number of times. It's a good introduction to the subject. The difference of irony, the seven types of irony, and the irony and the metaphor as a form of irony is a way to understand how the English language is used. Let me give one more final example. You know, people in school today don't know how to talk. They interpret words. They try to sound nice while interpreting words. But they don't convey ideas. You have, it's almost like you have a ticker tape talk. A guy has a script in front of him and he reads ticker, 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 you know, just like ticker tape talk. And there are no ideas in what he says. There are words in there, but no ideas. You see in bad actors, they don't say anything. They make sounds, they make noises. Whereas all great classical art, great classical drama, is based on this principle of metaphor and irony, just as scientific discovery is. This is a subject in and of itself, and I've written a good deal on it, but that'll do for the moment.
Okay, the next question has been submitted electronically by the leader of one of the Muslim organizations in the United States. His question is as follows. Mr. LaRouche, As you know, as your convention is meeting today, there are demonstrations against the war going on in cities across the United States and across the world. Nevertheless, this administration, along with the government of Britain, seems determined to go to war. More disturbing, however, is that behind that war, we seem to be moving into a matrix of religious war against Muslims, both in the United States and globally. Our religion has been misrepresented as a violent one and as one which supports terrorism. As I know you know, that is not true. But would you please address what you see as the potential for the outbreak of full-scale religious war in this period?
First of all, do not accept the proposition in the terms delivered. The idea that someone in the West, for example, by some terrible misunderstanding, misapprehends Islam as inherently a violent religion. Don't even believe it. Don't believe the accusation. The people who make it don't believe it. So why argue against them when what they're saying they don't believe themselves? What do they believe? What they believe is very, very simple. They believe, and if you should read Gibbon on the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbon was a protege of Lord Shelburne, a famous enemy of the United States. The argument was that the Anglo-Dutch liberals who ruled 18th century England from the top, these fellows said the Roman Empire should never have fallen. And Gibbon says the reason it fell is because it had tolerated Christianity. And ever since then, these fellows in Britain have been trying to get rid of Christianity. And with some of these religious nuts running around in the name of Christianity, they've done a fairly good job. I think the President of the United States is a victim of that the thing currently. Right? And what they believe is this. They believe, as the Roman Empire did, they believe in getting rid of Christianity. There's no question about that. And they're doing a fairly good job in the churches and elsewhere. Huh? What they believe is, as the Romans did, that in order to control the planet as a whole, you've got to divide the planet into two principal areas. One area is the area you intend to rule under your system of law. The other part is the part you don't think it's worthwhile trying to rule. And you contain with by what was the Romans called a limes policy. You turn the Roman legions loose on the borders of the empire to commit genocide, as is being done in Africa today. Now, what they've decided is that since the danger is, from their standpoint, that Asia, Eurasia, might unite, as it is tending to unite now. Western Europe will not survive without developing its market relations with East and South Asia. So therefore, Eurasia as a whole, East, South, and West, and so forth, is an interdependent set of national economies, or emerging national economies. These are the great area of population, the great area of future growth of the planet. Therefore, Europe has a fundamental interest in relations with China, with Russia, with India, with Southeast Asia, and so forth. The Middle East is the crossroads between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. The issue is not oil, though oil is an issue. The issue is the crossroads. The issue is to prevent Eurasia from becoming united in a system of cooperation which becomes a threat to the kind of power that certain people in the United States and the Anglo-Dutch circles desire. And what the rise of the United States to success with Lincoln's victory and the 1876 centennial celebration of the United States founding, which point the United States represented the most effective economy on the planet. We were the world's leading economy as a national economy. The British were somewhat more powerful because they had more subjects from whom they could steal. that we as a nation state were the most powerful economy on the planet. Therefore, there was imitation of the United States and its policy in France, in Italy, and their struggle for national independence in Italy, in Germany from 1877 on under Bismarck, in Russia under Tsar Alexander II and under Menelyev's influence, in Japan under the influence of Henry C. Carey in founding industrial Japan in the 1870s, and in the leadership for a new China, which is sponsored by the United States through the career and work of Sun Yat-sen. So London saw this then, and a crowd in New York as well, the banking crowd in New York, saw this as the greatest threat to their rule of the world as imperial maritime power. Therefore, they started World War I to prevent cooperation among these nations of Europe by putting them at each other's throat in Eurasia. World War II was started for a very similar purpose called geopolitics. What we're seeing today is another case of geopolitics. The difference is that a bunch of nuts in the United States, closely associated with the right-wing, extreme right-wing Israelis, around Sharon, Netanyahu, and other degenerates of that type, real fascists, and they call themselves fascists, they are fascists, are allied in the idea of an American empire. Now, this empire concept has been developed by a head of British intelligence, Arab Bureau, Bernard Lewis, now officially a Princeton professor, who is the key advisor and has been since 1973 of both Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Their policy has been genocide against Africa and what they call the Accra Crisis policy under Brzezinski. The policy is to cause the Islamic world to explode as a Lemus targeted area to be destroyed. It has nothing to do with religion as such. It's a Lemus policy of trying to maintain world rule, Roman Empire style. And they come up with all this garbage, which you get like the questioner asking. He's asking, really, go ask Bernard Lewis, who was head of the British Arab Bureau, which is a creation of the British India Office, which after World War I split off the Arab Bureau from the British East India as a separate operation under Ghulam Pasha in Jordan. And Bernard Lewis became the key planner for that. And when Kissinger came into becoming the acting president of the United States under, or Nixon under him, then he was sent to Princeton to become a closer advisor and steerer of Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski. So the Kissinger-Brzezinski policy, is a policy which is related to the Bertrand Russell nuclear preventive war policy. This is pure evil. It's aimed at all humanity, but it is aimed at Islam, both because of the crossroads of the between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean, and because 101.3 billion Muslims, if you put that part of culture into chaos, then you cannot have peace in any part of Eurasia. And Eurasia is finished. And therefore you can rule the world. Rule the world! Under the Emperor Ariel Sharon or something like that. So one should not be taken in by these words and assume that the words are meant sincerely. These guys are worse than Hitler. They mean what they say they intend to do. But when they tell you the reasons and their motives, they are lying. Do not give them the dignity of saying they are against Islam. They don't care what Islam is. It makes no difference to them. They're determined to kill. And they put a label Islam on the target. And that's all they care about. So we should never give them the dignity of imagining that this... Look, who are these guys? Think about who are they. What is Mark Rich? Mark Rich is the guy who was behind the penetration directly of the Clinton presidency through Al Gore. Mark Rich's lawyer is Louis Libby, who's a key man for Dick Cheney. Who owns Joe Lieberman. Who owns McCain? What is the Hudson Institute? How many people in the United States, as politicians and others, are owned by names like Lauder, Bronfman, the Lansky mob, Max Fisher, and so forth and so on? This is international organized crime. And these guys have become super wealthy at the time we have been destroying our agriculture and industry. So you have a bunch of people who are second and third generation of straight criminals, mass criminals. And Mark Rich is a mass criminal in his own right. He's being hunted down in France for what crimes he committed there. These people, this is the constituency behind this. So don't dignify them by imagining that they are some misguided religious fanatic. They are simply, their religion is crime. Their religion is, their meeting reminds me of an infamous mock marriage ceremony performed publicly, homosexual marriage, performed publicly by the Emperor Nero.
Now, Lynn, we have another question that has been submitted electronically. This is a question from the Dominican, well, actually, it's from the Dominican Republic's ambassador in Egypt. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, would you please explain to me and to those of us listening, why exactly did the Soviet Union fall?
I did it. What, and it started, as I've said this before, but it is of interest to people. It's one of those things, involves a metaphor. I was concerned in 1974, 75, at some things coming out of certain circles in the United States and elsewhere, including an operation, desk operation, simulation called Operation Hilux 75. And I knew what was going on around Brzezinski and some others in the United States. And I saw that contrary to the generally accepted assumption that the SALT II process, the SALT I, SALT II, had brought the danger of nuclear war implicitly under control, that in reality quite the contrary was true. And what these monkeys were fooling with was bringing us again to the threshold of a potential nuclear war. Now, what I did is I intervened at that point, exactly in 1977, in the context of my having run against Carter, that is, the Carter who was owned by Brzezinski, because of what Brzezinski represented. And in the process, I developed an alternative approach, proposing that since the Soviet Union and the United States were among the principal victims of this crazy SALT, mutual assured destruction policy, that what if the United States and Soviet Union agree to do something they can do, and do it in a certain way? And the point was, is that both the United States and the Soviet Union in particular had the ability to launch the development of new types of systems, called new physical systems generically, which could defeat a missile launch, ballistic missile launch. Not immediately, but we would be able to develop that. Now, the idea was that if we could develop such agreement to do that, that agreement to develop such systems, together with other countries, would mean that we would end the danger of the so-called mutual assured destruction policy. My objective was, is that if we develop these technologies, looking at the situation in Asia, Africa, and so forth, we have many countries which desperately need a qualitative change in global technologies available. That these technologies which I was proposing, in terms of interception, anti-ballistic missile systems, would be a material benefit for our space exploration and for developing these so-called third world countries. And therefore, I propose essentially that an agreement be reached between the Soviet government and the United States government to promote cooperation to such end to free the planet from the threat of thermonuclear war. Now, it happened that because of a series of accidents, which weren't really accidents, one at a New Hampshire meeting where I happened to be sitting next to Ronald Reagan, who was then running for president, I was running for president, and we were at the same end of the table while all the other fellows were gambling away there. And we had a little chat, not of much consequence, but it was just an acquaintanceship. And to follow on that, I had played a key role in defeating George Bush's chances for the presidential nomination that time. Well, the result was that Reagan became the president, though George Bush became the vice president later. So in the process, when the transition occurred, after the election in November of 1980, I went to Washington and met with various people, the Democratic Party, Republican Party, and the incoming Reagan administration. And a process developed, which was ongoing at the time that we had an approach from a Soviet representative in the United Nations, who said they were interested in opening up a new channel of discussion with the United States with a new administration. So I transmitted that information to relevant people in the U.S. government, in the executive branch, and got back and shot all of the requests that I undertake to open up a back channel discussion with the Soviet government, which with hemming and hawing we did. Now the basis for the discussion was an agreement that I would put in as an exploratory point of discussion my proposal for strategic ballistic missile defense of this type. As you probably know, that this started between February of 1982 and my last discussion with the Soviets in that connection personally was in February of 1983. At that point, wasn't sure the Reagan administration was interested, the Reagan presidency was interested in adopting my policy. Over the opposition of Danny Graham and many other people who were on the opposite line. So I had this meeting in February, and the Soviet representative told me that the Soviet government had turned down the idea. The idea was, I had said, if the President of the United States were to offer you this, with this implication, how would you react? How would your government react? The answer was, we would reject it out of hand, even though your argument is correct scientifically, we agree it would work, our government would reject it. So I relayed that information to the Reagan White House, and then President Reagan, March 23rd, later made that proposal, the exact proposal that I had outlined to the Soviet government in the back channel. In the meantime, I told the Soviet representative, I said, you've got to tell your government this is nuts, in effect. Because if you try to do, if you respond in the way you say you will respond, I can guarantee you the Soviet economy will collapse within 5 years. Then later, in the spring of that year, I repeated that without referring to the occasion. I repeated that statement publicly. And the Soviet Union collapsed in 6 years, not five. And the reason the Soviet Union collapsed is because the Soviet government, in the person of Yuri Andropov personally, who was tied to Arm & Hammer and tied to all other kinds of funny people, and Gorbachev, who was his protege, these guys went with that policy. Now, this is the same thing as the Mark Rich policy. Who is Mark Rich? Who is Louis Libby's Mark Rich? Mark Rich is the key figure of what is called the Russian Mafia. These are people, not Mark himself, but his friends inside Russia, were members of the Andropov kindergarten. These were bright and rising, shining stars of the Soviet KGB, who were trained by Andropov to become a new generation of Soviet leaders. And what they did beginning from about the middle of the 1980s on, up to the present day, is they looted the former Soviet Union, while it was still a Soviet Union otherwise. They became tied with the middleman on this was the Israeli right wing. This crowd of Israeli right wing gangsters, like working with people like Mark Rich in Zug, Switzerland, were the people who looted the former Soviet Union, both as a Soviet Union and as an ex-Soviet Union, massively. They became this powerful instrument called the Russian Mafia, of which Mark Rich is the center. And this is what controls, in large degree, the crowd which is the war party around Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, and so forth, and Ariel Sharon and company today. So this crowd, in a sense, the Soviet Union collapsed, it collapsed itself. But when I put the thing on the table about the alternative, and Reagan accepted it and made the offer on March 23rd, 1983, and the Soviet government rejected it out of hand, and it was not a rejection on considerate rejection, it was out of hand, directly, immediately, no, yet. That condemned the Soviet Union to collapse, not in 5 years, but in six.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's keynote address at the President's Day Conference 2003. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.